Like the office they commemorate, presidential libraries are living institutions. Certainly, it is my hope that the Reagan Library will become a dynamic intellectual forum where scholars interpret the past and policymakers debate the future.
Welcome to a Reagan Forum, hosted by the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute. The Center for Public Affairs offers lectures and forums presenting perspectives on important public policy issues of the day, from politicians, authors, members of the media, business and military leaders, and more. In this week's Reagan Forum, we go back 2 weeks to our virtual program with presidential advisor David Gergen. David joined us to discuss the release of his latest book, Hearts Touched with Fire: How Great Leaders Are Made. David Gergen began his career in journalism and later as the director of the Center for Public Leadership at the Kennedy School. During his career, he also served as White House advisor to 4 U.S. presidents of both parties, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. During President Reagan's administration, David served as the director of communications. Speaking about David, Ronald Reagan once said, "Dave is devoted to honest, open, and decent government." Hearts Touched by Fire is a powerful guide to the art of leadership. During the conversation with Reagan Foundation and Institute Executive Director John Heibusch, David shared lessons of effective leadership from his experiences as a White House advisor, his decades as a trusted voice on national issues, and years of teaching and mentoring young people to offer a stirring playbook for the next generation of changemakers. Let's listen.
David Gergen, just what a pleasure it is to have you online with us, not just to talk with you, but most especially about a terrific book. You know, as you know, there are must be tens of thousands of books out there on leadership yes. development. I read this cover to cover. It's terrific, and you're really to be congratulated for putting this work together.
Well, thank you very, very much, John. I did hope that it would be a book that would not only be read by a wide spectrum of people, but especially by the young, the emerging young leaders of tomorrow, because I think so much in America rests upon how successful they are. And I think those of us who are older have a duty, a responsibility to help them grow and mature and become great leaders on their own. So the book was intended to do that. One lesson I learned from President Reagan, among many, is have some good stories available. So, you know, he always did. I've been living off Reagan stories for these many years now, over 40 years. But in any event, this is an ideal time to write something. And there's urgency because the country is obviously on an unsustainable path. I tell people it's like we're driving on the edge of a cliff in a car without headlights and rain beating down on us. And you never know when you're going to go over the edge. As long as you're on the front, as long as you're on top driving along, you can get very complacent. We should not be complacent about what we're going through now. And I know for certain, although I'm sure there'll be people who disagree, I think President Reagan would have had a very different take on this and would have had been pushing some the values that he represented and embraced, values that were more traditional American values. That's why he was so much in the mainstream in many, many ways. But I think he would have been repelled by some of the radicalism that we're seeing on both sides of the aisle.
Yeah. Well, your opinion is certainly credible on this one. You worked directly for the man for several years.
Well, I did. I was not as, to be honest about it, I was not as conservative as he was. I was pro-choice, for example. But I did find it to be a privilege to work for him. And I've always regarded, even though I have some differences on politics, I think he was the best leader we've had in the White House since Jack Kennedy.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Let's talk about leadership, David. I think I know the answer given the subtitle of your book, but I'm going to ask the question anyways. Hearts Touched with Fire: How Great Leaders Are Made. So, in your opinion, are great leaders born? It's just something that comes with the genes, or can someone actually learn to be a great leader?
I think that great leaders early on have the makings of leadership. It's hard to spot them, but I once had a fascinating conversation with Lee Kuan Yew. He visited from Singapore to the Kennedy School where I teach, and I asked him, what's the secret to Singapore's success under your leadership? because here, yeah, it was a third world country, it was going nowhere, and suddenly this cosmopolitan center and big trading center. And he said, you know, it's you really have to spot the up and coming leaders. He said, it's like a sheep herder going out and visiting the puppies and sort of looking at each one very closely and examining it, and then saying, yes, this one and this one. And those are the ones we're going to work with. And I do think that finding young leaders, identifying them, encouraging them and working with them, I think we can make a difference. But to go to your point, I think some people have the predilections, some of the strengths. But I do think after that, it's a lot of hard work about becoming a leader and developing your values, developing your sort of true north, as Bill George likes to say. And I think that's the work of a lifetime. So that I think in the long run, the great leaders are self-made. They're people who have recognized become aware of their strengths and weaknesses and tried to master some of the weaknesses and tried to build the strengths. But that right from the beginning, it's a journey. Leadership is about a journey. And it's never over, but you can always improve yourself, and you should continually be trying to do that.
Yeah, I think in your book, David, you note that there's something like, at least you found, over 200 definitions of what it means to be a leader.
Yes.
In a sentence or two, so I'll put that discipline on you, a sentence or two, define for me how you would define leadership.
Well, the shorthand version that I have embraced for a number of years is a leader is someone who mobilizes others in the pursuit of shared goals. Leader's a person who stirs up others and motivates them to pursue shared goals. So what we're talking about here is you have to have a leader, but you have to have followers. You know, who knew better? Reagan knew that better than almost anybody else. He built a huge following, and it made his presidency much more effective because there were so many people who believed in him and followed him before he got to the White House. And that was an important part of his development. But I think true leaders are made, and bad leaders are broken by their early experiences. Let me contrast Reagan, what I just said about Reagan, with Richard Nixon. He was the first president I worked for, and I was honored. It's an honor for an American to work for any president. So I've been very blessed in life. But what I found about Nixon was that he was actually the best strategist about international relations of anybody I've ever met. And he just generally thought strategically. He had a sense of that a vision, what a leader needs is a vision and then a strategy for carrying it out, and the value is to keep going and to uphold it. And Nixon is a best strategist. He could figuratively go up on a mountaintop and look toward the past and see where we come from, and then look out the other way into the future. Winston Churchill once said that he who can see farther back can see farther ahead. And that was certainly true for Nixon. And had that been everything about Nixon we needed to know, he would have been one of the better presidents. But in fact, as you well know, John, he had demons inside him that he had never learned to control. And they derailed him. You know, in the end of the day, he was the author of his own failures. It's harsh to say, but it other leaders can learn from that. If you don't develop your values and have some sense of the difference between right and wrong and be thinking in those terms, you can get yourself in deep trouble pretty quickly in a game of politics, which is it ain't beanbag. It's not, you know, politics is a contact sport, and you have to be tough. You have to have tough skin. You got to grow into it. But you got to have that inner strength. Think about this with Reagan again. When he came to Washington as president, you know, he was well formed by then. There was not a lot of growth that was coming, because that's one of the reasons he was so successful. He was well formed. He was well developed. And by the way, it was also important to come from a big, complex state, you know, someplace which is. Requires the leader, the governor, whoever it may be, to work with the other side, to see more than one perspective and about, you know, what's right and what's wrong. So I think this leadership development is one of the most important things that we who are in older and people who are in the private sector have to sort of think about: how are we going to train up the next generation? How do we help them have those lessons? The truth is that one of the most important training grounds for leadership in our society is the military. You know, the West Point is probably, I would say West Point is the best leadership development center in the country.
Yeah.
Because it's all on the line for them. Colin Powell once told me, you know, one of the things about the military is when they need a new person at the top or somewhere, you know, in command of something, they have to choose from within. They can't do a worldwide search as a private company can, looking for a CEO. In the military, you've got to turn to somebody else in the military. So it's in everybody's self-interest to make sure the people who come up and are 2, 3, 4 star generals are extremely well prepared to handle whatever may come their way. And we've been fortunate that way. I think the military has become in Vietnam was so, you know, derided. It's now one of our most trusted institutions.
That's right. Yeah. You're absolutely right. In the military, you better be good at succession planning because you don't have any other choice. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right.
Now, in the book, I don't think I recall that you labeled them this way. I will, but okay. I'll call them the three C's in
the what?
Courage, the three C's.
Oh, three C's.
Yeah.
You're right. Courage, capability,
and character.
Courage,
and character. And character.
Yeah. Right? You know, and if Churchill argued that courage was the most important of those three. He said, without that, you had nothing else. There's a historian that I used to read a lot, who's now no longer with us, but who argued that if you look at how, this Barbara Tuchman was her name, she wrote a book called The March of Folly, examining society since going back to the classical period. And so Greeks and Romans going way, way back, but she traced it from our political development and what happened in society after society right up to Vietnam. And she raised the question, is it possible to prepare people for governance, for successful governance? And she said, well, many societies have tried, and she went through this historical record on that. But, you know, and as I say, going from the Trojan horse days to Vietnam, she said many societies have tried to develop leaders well. It has lasted only a short time in every society. Usually they've given way to corruption. She said, but if there's one thing that, you know, we should be training people for in leadership, it's character. It is character. And I think that I think courage and character actually go together in a lot of ways.
Yeah. How do you teach those critical ingredients, courage, characters? Do you feel like it's, at the end of the day, it's really derived from your upbringing and your family? Or nope, you can sit down at a class at a leadership training school at Harvard and here you go, here's some courage.
well, you often don't know who's courageous until the trouble hits, do you?
Right.
And it's not always the person who's got a lot of ribbons on their lapel. It's not always the person who's, you know, had 20 years. It's often, I found that in the Navy, I was in the Navy for 3.5 years and had 50 young seamen who reported to me. It was one of the best learning experiences I could possibly have had. But what I discovered was you didn't know who was really tough, who really had the inner strength until there was a crisis. And then in a crisis, you begin to see who's good and who's not good and who gets scared. And I, you know, one of the things I found was the best people often are ones who sort of don't show their cards. They don't show all those cards about courage until trouble hits. And then they stand up and they're terrific. And look at Zelensky, you know, in Ukraine. Perfect example of someone who was, you know, he came out of the entertainment world.
Right.
Who would have thought he would be as brave as he is?
Yeah,
but it's, you know, he stirred not only the people of Ukraine, he stirred people all over the world. And in fact, I think in America, one of the questions we should be asking, because we've had so many leadership failures, where are our Zelenskys? Mm-hmm. Where are the people we can look up to and as heroes? We tend to, unfortunately, I think we tend to tear people down when they get to the top. There's this real, it's a sort of a king of the mountain kind of game. And when you get to the top, that's when people come after you. And it's very, very, it's easy with social media being, it's easy to get instant attention. You know, you say something outrageous and you probably get some attention on it. But it's very, and so it's easy to get the, and to get what appears to be power, but it's really hard then to execute the power. You know, look at AOC, and she came out of nowhere. You have to give her credit for that. I disagree with her politics, but I respect the fact that she's so passionate about change. I think it's a healthy thing. We have people like her in our system. But the, you know, all of this goes to say that we simply have to, I think, focus on who is likely to do well. And I have found, and one of the things I'm more hopeful, one of the reasons I'm more hopeful is that in the short term, I think we're in for real trouble still. I think we're a few more years of real trouble. But I do think that the prospects for the long term are brightening. And that is because we do have a number of people who are coming through now, young people, who are resisting the direction we're going and really want to bring the country to a better place. They are going to inherit this country after all. And they want a climate, they want to inherit a climate that, you know, does not broil us to death or just, you know, brings forest fires and fires all over California. You know, you just don't want to live in a society like that very long. So all of us have a self-interest in coming to grips with these things, but we're so paralyzed with the older generation is so paralyzed that I'm less and less convinced the older generation can solve these problems. I think it's going to be the younger generation that we're going to rely upon heavily. I also think, and I think Reagan was personified this so much, you know, he took this age issue seriously as president. He was, you know, he wanted to make sure, and I always felt that, you know, as he grew older, he did lose some of his step, but he left. Actually, you know, he was his age when he left office was lower than the first day of some of the people who are running for president now. I really think it's a mistake to have people running the White House who are 80 years old, 85 years old. As much as I admire people who are elderly and they can be sages and they can help in all sorts of important ways, there's still roles to be played by older people.
Right.
But I think the people who are in the Oval Office, I think you need people. And Reagan realized that. Reagan was not afraid to have some really smart people working for him.
That's right. Yeah.
And he didn't feel uncomfortable with that at all.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the hallmarks of his success was attracting terrific people, right?
Exactly.
In your book, David, I'll quote you.
Sure.
You wrote, leadership at its best is service to others.
Yes.
Do you think that someone can be defined as a great leader if their service is really to themselves? I mean, they might really be talented, you know.
No.
But does that define a great leader?
No, no. What greatness comes from those who are able to do big things. It's not only that you have a set of values and your moral purpose, but it is that you can find ways to actually get things done. I mean, it's empty if you have a moral purpose to be proclaiming all these things and then not work for them.
So
it's important to fill that out. And I think there's a real question of what we do to help young people do that. They obviously, you know, so many people coming out of college today, I find all over the country, I'm very encouraged by, there are an awful lot of people who want to get into service jobs. They find the capitalism somehow doesn't fit their I don't know who they are very well. It doesn't sing to them. But they're very, very committed to serving, but they just don't know how to do it. I've become a big believer, and I write about this in the book, a big believer in national service. And, you know, John McCain became a big believer in this. Bill Buckley, Reagan would like this, you know, was a big advocate of national service. He wanted involuntary. He wanted to have a draft, in effect, and have people come in. But the whole point is, if you give a year back when you're young, or maybe even 2 years, give a year back when you're young to your community, and you really, you know, get involved in a nonprofit organization or even with the government, but in a way that you give back, then I think you should have your tuition debt reduced by a year, so that you not only are paid a modest salary, but that you can work off your debt. Because people who are heavily in debt really have a hard time engaging in service. You know, they're just too pressed for trying to keep food on the table and making sure their kids go to decent schools.
Let's talk about the difference between a great manager and a great leader. In your book, you quote Warren Bennis, who says, the manager does things right, the leader does the right thing.
Exactly.
Expand on that.
Yeah, well, when Warren Bennis, it was a grand, wonderful guru. He was a mentor of mine and a dear friend, and I miss him. And this book is written very much with Warren in mind. And you'll find his name on many pages and his wisdom on many pages, because he was the man, you know, he was the University of California, USC, in his last 20, 30 years. And he was a real sage for so many, especially in the business community. But he wrote a book on becoming a leader, which there are many similarities, parallels, because I learned a lot from Warren about it. And we shared a lot of stories together. But the whole point was that the leader, the manager does do the right things. But it's the leader who really, it's the leader who actually leads, and the manager builds, creates, and plays an important role, but it's in effect, the manager is the COO, it's the leader who's the CEO, and those are different jobs, those are different propositions.
Yeah.
And, you know, doing the right thing is what the leader's doing, doing things right is what the management doing. I think that's what Warren was saying.
Yeah, got it. You mentioned earlier, David, the importance of having a North Star. I remember in Hemingway he would call it, you know, every man should have a moral compass, as it were.
Yes, exactly.
Why does that need to be at the center of being a great leader?
Because I think first and foremost, there's been such an erosion of trust in our institutions and in our leaders, that I think we've allowed them to be politicized far beyond what they deserve, and it really paralyzed us in our politics. So one of the things about Reagan was how much respect he had for the presidency as an institution. You know, he would never go in the Oval Office unless he had a coat and tie on. When he was shot, as you'll recall, And the ambulance or the Secret Service pulled him up to the hospital, he got out of the car on the other side from the press, so they couldn't really see him as he got out and worked. But what he did was he straightened up his tie, and then he walked from behind around the car and walked up to the doctors. And what the press saw was a man who was standing up, seemed to be, you know, vigorous, seemed to be okay. But when he got to the other side, he collapsed into the arms of the doctors. But that's how much respect he did not want to see. He didn't want to have the American people watch a president fall to the ground and be crawling in a way that it would just be catastrophic. And so I think that was his North Star. I think he always believed in the importance of, you know, he had sort of tried to have a simplified Midwestern view of life, and that rotates around, you know, honesty and integrity, and, you know, you can count in character that you can count on in the long run. It's Harry Truman, it's Dwight Eisenhower. You can go through a long list of people who really care about the well-being. Franklin Roosevelt said that at the end of the day, the most important thing a president was a moral leader, because, and he said it in this sense, and that is, issues that kind of divide us need to be resolved through a process and a culture that allows many voices to express themselves. And Reagan really wanted to protect that approach to to leadership, and I think it did distinguish him. But you know, I've always felt that when Charles de Gaulle died in France, it was said that de Gaulle was not great because he was in France. De Gaulle was great because France was in him. And I always felt what was remarkable about Reagan was not that he was in America, but America was in him. He sort of personified and lived in a way. Again, and I didn't share all his political views, but I thought as a human being, as a leader, I became enormously respectful of his leadership.
Yeah. Let me quote again from the book and
sure.
The purpose of this quote, after I lay it out for you, is to talk to you about the times we live in. And here's your quote. You write, "In my experience, the people who have achieved the greatest understanding of their inner selves have been reflective practitioners. Those
yes.
who have welcomed a wide array of experience, have read history and biographies with care, and have had a series of conversations with their inner selves." Now, the question I have for you with that quote in mind is, with the advent of so much social media today and Twitter and people quick to the trigger on how they feel about something, do you think, I mean, social media is a real benefit to our society, but do you also feel like it can be a real, create real difficulties for us because people are not being reflective practitioners as you
yes.
feel leaders need
yes.
to be?
And I think that it's one of the reasons I push Zelensky, because I think he represents the kind of values. But we've had individuals that come through. I think of John McCain, or I wrote about Katherine Graham of the Washington Post. And also Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And what is important to understand is that a lot of young people have never experienced much adversity in life. You know, things have gone, especially if you're a middle class suburban family, you have loving parents, you have a lot of things that are going well for you, but you've never faced a lot of adversity. And the big tests come when you do have adversity. John McCain going to POW, our POWs in Vietnam were the longest serving prisoners of war in any of our wars. But, you know, the way he was tortured he, right from the beginning, or Jim Stockdale, who was a friend of his, and, you know, Stockdale was also, I think, a very memorable creature. But I find other reflective practitioners, look at General Mattis, who's a warrior leader, but also a warrior scholar. He reads incessantly. He reads history, he reads biography, and he's wise way beyond his years. I have enormous respect for him. Sometime, if you'd like, General Mattis has said he'd like to come out with the two of us, come out and do a couple of events together. If you'd like to do that sometime, and you know, because he's not far up the road. He's up at Stanford.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah. You know, John, when he was like a 4-star and he had billets, he changed his billets, he would take his books with him. You know how many books he had with him? 7,000. 7,000. And he makes the argument, if you become a 3-star, a 4-star, if you haven't read about something, he has some 200 books, then you're not ready to lead. You're not ready to bring the kind of advice and, you know, it's remarkable. But General Mattis did endorse this book. If you'll see on the back flap, I was honored to get his endorsement. But he said, "I think you're on the right track, trying to work with the younger generation, and I want to help all I can."
Yeah, that's neat. I've had the honor of introducing him here. Now, the subject was a big defense forum, but bet I would love to. What a program that would be to have the two of you here together talking broadly about leadership.
Yes.
In fact, let me use him as an example for another point you made in the book, and that is that leaders need to have a longer time horizon and essentially think of themselves as leadership as a lifetime commitment. Mattis is perfectly representative of that, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, he's in for the long haul.
Yeah.
He wasn't a celebrity. You know, it's easy. Celebrities sort of come and go pretty quickly, you know. They're the light comes on them, they glow for a while, but you know, they have their 15 minutes of fame. Yeah. But they tend to pass, and it's the heroes we remember.
Yeah, that's right.
And the people who, you know, one of the things that changed the public's perception of Reagan was the shooting, and how brave he was in responding to it, you know, with humor even. And as I say, being respectful of the office. But people walked away with, I was among those who thought, you know, he's a much tougher guy than I thought. He's a much stronger person than I had understood, because that he had that kind of inner strength. And it is when the chips are down. Let me tell you a Nixon story that illustrates point. You know, I said that Nixon was a very good strategist, and but those demons did him in. He called me just a few weeks before he died, and a sort of a reflective conversation about his life. And he said one of his proudest moments came early on when he went to Congress. He came back from the war in 45. In 1946, he was elected, Nixon was elected to Congress, the House of Representatives, as a Republican. And that was the time that the Republicans swept the White House, took the White House back, took the Congress back. And Harry Truman was president. Eventually they took the White House back, but Harry Truman was president, and, you know, was in trouble. But Truman in particular saw that Europe was going to fall into crisis, and the Soviets would take over, were we not to intervene with the Marshall Plan. Marshall Plan was actually named after George Marshall, the most popular person in the country at that time, a man of real character and courage, I might add. But when the Marshall Plan came out, the American people were basically exhausted, John. You know, they were emotionally exhausted. They thought we'd already sent lots of blood and treasure to Europe. Did we really have to do that again? So when it first came out, the first Gallup poll on the Marshall Plan showed it only had 18% support. And so the White House went to work, and they reached out. Democratic White House reached out to Nixon. They reached out to other players in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And eventually, they working together in a bipartisan fashion, the approval rating for the Marshall Plan gradually crept up and up and up. So it got to be a point you could actually do it. But it was still a stretch. But Nixon said one of his proudest moments as a freshman member of Congress, when the Marshall Plan was put to a vote, a Democratic plan put to a vote that most people, Americans, didn't want in the beginning. When it was put to a vote, Richard Nixon stood up on one side of the aisle in favor of the Marshall Plan. And there on the other side of the aisle was a new Democratic member of the House of Representatives, John F. Kennedy, who was also standing up. And yeah. Nixon's point to me was, when the chips are down in this country, we stand up together. That was the tradition that we had for so long. It was the reason we stuck together as a people. We've been through some pretty awful experiences, very challenging times, when a lesser country, a lesser democracy would have collapsed. But time and again, with one exception, as John Meacham, the historian, has pointed out, we've had at least four existential crises. One in the beginning as a nation, when we were threatened to our very core. I mean, in the beginning with the fight to establish a republic, it was a very close call, almost went the other way. You know, Washington lost the first 6 out of 8 battles that he fought. But somehow we pulled ourselves together, and that we got through that period. So that's one we won. We lost the Civil War in terms of the buildup of the Civil War, and it took an awful lot to overcome that. And I just walked the street, the battlefields of Gettysburg this last weekend with James McPherson, who's one of our best historians. And so it was a wonderful experience, But you can see how close we came to the edge there. But then in the Depression, the Great Depression, you know, with Franklin Roosevelt's leadership and a lot of Republicans helping out, you know, we succeeded in getting done through that crisis. And then the crisis of World War II itself, which was existential crisis. We've come through 3 out of 4 pretty well.
Yeah.
And that should give us encouragement you know, because I firmly believe Abigail Adams wrote a letter to her young teenage son, John Quincy, and she argued that it was in times of adversity, hard times, that's when great leaders step forward. Yeah. That's what you see. There's people who say, I'm here, I'll take the baton, I'll run with it. Yeah. And I think, frankly, it's time to pass the baton to a new generation.
More from our Reagan Forum with David Gergen after this message.
The Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation is the nonprofit organization created by President Reagan himself, and specifically charged by him with continuing his legacy and sharing his principles: individual liberty, economic opportunity, global democracy, and national pride. We must remain vigilant and work together to share these conservative principles with younger generations. Your role is critical to move our mission forward. Thank you for your continued support. Please visit ReaganFoundation.org/give. That's ReaganFoundation.org/give.
Now, back to our Reagan Forum with David Gergen.
You make a point in the book about if you're trying to grow as a leader, the need to find your authentic self. And in it, you say, look, be careful. You don't want to just pick out leaders and try to copy them. Yes. This is really going to be all about you. I wanted you to just comment on little leadership model I made up on my own as I went through my career. And that is, as I found myself working for people I admired who I felt were great leaders, I would always just try to take one aspect of that person, one strength, emulate that, you know? I just want you to talk about the authenticity when it comes to leadership.
Well, there is a school of thought that you just can adjust your personality and everything to the people you're talking to. I think that today we live in a society in which we need more straight talk, and stop yelling at each other and start listening more to each other. But keep it straight. Keep it. You know, we need to be able to talk about bad things, tough things. We need to be able to talk about race and gender in ways that people don't feel threatened but honored. And it's particularly important with all the inequities and the inequalities that exist. And I think this is something Reagan embraced, was that, you know, that we need to be a fair society, a society in which people have an equal break, an equal chance in life. It's not that everybody should come out the same way and have the same benefits, because you have to earn them. We shouldn't be giving things to people. Student debt, personally, I would like to see us reduce the student debt, but I think you ought to be giving something in return to do it. Mm. You know, that's why I talked about national service. You ought to be giving back to your community. It shouldn't be just a gift. I think it's got to be, you got to have some skin in the game. And you got to have some sense of commitment. But this True North thing, It does have roots in the past, obviously. Bill George, who is a very good friend, and I think is also, he's sort of a Peter Drucker, Warren Bennis protege. He's written 2 or 3 books about a moral compass and your true north, finding your true north. And his argument is authenticity is the way to get to your true north. But to really, when you're authentic to yourself, you as a self, as a reflective practitioner, let us say, if you're 25 years old, you should be starting to think about what do I really believe in? What values do I? What are my core beliefs? What do I want to see accomplished in this life? Where do I fit into it? That's about finding your true north, and it can be complicated. It can take a long time. It to become a true leader can sometimes be the work of a lifetime. And you just, change is hard. We go all the way back to Machiavelli, and who made the point that, you know, those who benefit from the status quo are going to oppose change, and those who actually say they like change actually are fearful underneath that it won't work out very well for them. So he said it's really, really very, very hard to put together a coalition in favor of change. And it's, and he goes on to make some arguments about, you know, the ends justify the means that I don't accept as readily. But I think Machiavelli was right about how hard it is to change. You know, I went through the 60s and I thought for sure that we were going to change about civil rights. And I thought by the time I die, I'm sure that I have to believe the United States will have solved its underlying racial problem. And we haven't, mm-hmm. You know, we still have elements of systemic racism. We're a lot better than we were. And I think there are some people who run us, whatever we do, they run us down. You know, America is always a favorite, you know, target now for a lot of people, our colonial fathers and so forth. And, I think we're too ready to, you know, tear down the statues. We ought to be respectful of what Jefferson represented, as opposed to, yes, it's important that he had this black woman who was a slave and that he had children by her. It's extremely important that we know that history. But Thomas Jefferson stands for so much more than that, and so much more, so many more accomplishments. And I think if you go through our great leaders, that's true. One of the things, I don't mean to gas on too much, John, so let me turn this back over, but I would point out something Warren Bennis used to ask me. I didn't have a good answer. He pointed out that when we were a young country of 3 million people back in colonial times, the United States managed to produce 6 world-class leaders. 6. We had George Washington, we had John Adams, we had Jefferson, we had Hamilton, we had Madison, and who am I leaving out? But the Franklin. So we had 6 world-class leaders. Today, America is 330 million, many, many, many times more than we had then. And yet we have a hard time finding any world-class leaders.
Yeah, well,
there's something in the water these days.
Yeah,
we're tearing people down, or they get beaten up so easily. It's I don't know why people take such pleasure. And I go back to your point about social media. I do think social media is very much a two-edged sword. It can help you create a sense of national conversation, but it can also be a cesspool. It can be a sewer line. Running through your, you know, your den or your living room or something, because the stuff that's on there is just so, oh, come on, give me a break, you know. And so, you know, a mature society should be able to overcome those things. So
right.
But I want to come back to it. I can't tell you how I balance off my sort of like fear of what's coming in the next 3 or 4 years, because I think it's going to be pretty gruesome. But I do think that there are so many signs now of a younger generation stepping up and saying, I'm here, I want to help. I see 2 big, great streams now of people coming through my classrooms and other institutions who were so helpful, who give me so much hope. And that's young people coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq who went over there as volunteers and fought over there, put their lives on the line. And they come back and they remind me so much of the World War II generation.
Yeah.
And I'm part of an organization called With Honor. It's a nonprofit that we're identifying people we think coming back, military veterans coming back, who would like to get into public service, you know, and they want to do something. They may take a job with a corporation, but they want to do something on the side. They're really dedicated to that. And I there are terrific young people coming through that, and they're with Honor. We try to help people on both sides of the aisle win their congressional seats, so that a couple of years, 3 or 4 years ago, we had 20 people who won seats. 10 were Democrats and 10 were Republicans. Mm-hmm. And they all signed pledges to work in a bipartisan fashion. So we have the veterans coming back. But the other thing, on the other end of the spectrum, there's so many young black women now who are stepping forward, becoming reformers. They act with moral purpose. They have to a significant degree have the moral high ground, and they invented the Me Too movement. They invented Black Lives Matter movement. They've given the black community hope that we can turn things around. when we've had record-breaking marches now on various issues. It used to be that people who marched were people of color, especially blacks. Now you see the whites, young white people, millennials, you know, right up there demonstrating too. And I think that's very, very encouraging. Before we go, I want to talk about one other thing. That's the importance of humor. But it's your show. Let's keep going. You're doing a great job.
Yeah, I was going. In fact, boy, you hit it right. As you well know from personal experience, Ronald Reagan knew how to use humor in his own leadership experience as well. Yeah. But I wanted to ask about leadership and mistakes.
Leadership where?
And leadership and mistakes.
As in mistake, yes.
Do you think that leaders learn more, gain more from their defeats or from their victories?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think you gain more when you're young from defeats. I don't trust anybody, frankly. when people are running for office, for high office, I want to know something about their friendships. Do their friendships, are they something where like happened 10 minutes ago when they became celebrities? Or are their friendships and their values something that you saw were there before they became, you know, became prominent? And if somebody has no friends when they were, all the friends came, you know, came into their lives when they got rich or got prominence, I don't trust that person. You know, I just sort of, my instinctively, I have more faith and trust in people who've been friends for years, you know, go back. I think I try to go to my high school reunions. I think it's important to show up there, even though, you know, we've all drifted so far apart. But nonetheless, I think that that leadership is about more than trying to run a program or a policy. I think leadership is about creating a culture and a following that, you know, can sustain hard times and can help you get through things, and people try to work together. I mean, it made such a difference in World War II that you had a salt install from Massachusetts who was saluting some Polish kid from Brooklyn. You know, that we were democratizing in a small D way, and very, very effectively. And we just don't see a lot of that now. I'm sort of hung up on the military in that sense, because I think they are one of the unifying forces in our country, can be one of the unifying forces, and we need more like them. One of the things about the World War II generation, which started with, in terms of power, with Jack Kennedy when he was elected in 1960, but went through George H.W. Bush when he was last elected in 1988. And we had seven presidents during that period, starting with Kennedy, ending with Bush Sr. Every single one of them wore a military uniform.
Right.
Jimmy Carter, the war ended while he was still in the Naval Academy, but he went on to serve honorably as a Marine officer, as you know. So I thought, if you look at that group, they brought so much to the table. They were not perfect. They did give us Vietnam. They gave us Watergate. So you have to have some caution here, but nonetheless, when they left office, when they started leaving the stage, as they're starting to do now, and I think more of them need to leave the stage, but when they started leaving the stage, World War II, they left behind a nation that was the strongest since Rome, economically, culturally, militarily. The world looked to us with awe. They didn't always like what they saw, but they were awed by it. And now, you know, the baby boomers get ready to leave. It's not like that at all. We have crisis after crisis that has gone on, you know, not solved. And we're exhausted, emotionally exhausted, and people are losing faith. We've lost so much trust. One of the reasons I think this whole abortion issue, the Supreme Court is now, you know, getting battered over these kind of issues and being accused of being politicized, and, you know, that they're not basing their decisions on the law or stare decisis. They're based on, you know, what pressures they're under from whatever backgrounds in there, you know. So I think we have a lot of work to do, but I think we can do it with a good heart. And I think we can do it with a sense of, let's work with these younger generations. Let's really help them. And they'll do great things for us.
Yeah, well put. You know, there's an adage that I'm sure that you've heard about, David, and it goes, never meet your heroes. You know, I think it stems from the fact that all of us, I mean, even great leaders, like you'd reference, you know, Richard Nixon, have our flaws, right?
Yes.
So leaders are not perfect people, are they?
No, and I think it's really, really important point. I've tried to tell people who are going to, you know, young people who went into politics, we're going to go work in Washington, or better yet, work in the state houses or local mayor's offices and that sort of thing, that you're not going to meet a perfect person, and you have to be prepared for the fact that people, almost everybody has feet of clay. And what you want and what you desire is a person, you know, Nelson Mandela was the first to tell you that he was a flawed individual, but he lived a purposeful life.
Right.
And, you know, the moral purpose that Mandela represented, you know, I think justifies everything he stood for. And is one of the reasons we should continue looking to him. There are not a whole lot of people you can say stand out for their moral courage. You know, Dietrich Bonhoeffer would be another, for example, and, you know, he was a Lutheran pastor. He went back to Germany and, you know, to sure death, in effect, but he was standing up against Hitler. That was moral purpose that I think you can go for. And I do think people find their moral purpose usually in defeat and in adversity, because they have to figure out, okay, what do I really believe in, and what legacy do I want? You know, as you get older, you ask yourself, I'm of that age now, about, okay, what legacy is involved here, and let's keep it simple.
Yeah. You focus in one chapter I thought was interesting on the concept of stoicism.
Yes.
And how great leaders often have the sense of stoicism.
Yes. Yeah.
They talk about that.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know much about the Stoics until I'd read some stuff, but Epictetus, I didn't really quite, you know, I hadn't read a lot of it. Marcus Aurelius was also a very, very important figure in this. So Stoicism is a concept, goes back to the Greeks and the Romans, and it is the notion that, and to put it simply, the notion that, listen, we're always, all of us are under a lot of stress. Some people have just taken on the world's problems, and they're under a huge amount of stress. But you need almost to have like a Buddhist type view of things. There are certain things you can't control in life. And the things that you can't control, you should stop worrying about them. There's not much if you can't control it, don't destroy yourself, you know, worrying about something you can't control. What you need to do is work on what you can control, and to make that central to your life and care about that. And you can then withhold and withstand almost any adversity, you know. But Jim Stockdale, I mentioned, who was a prisoner of war, I wrote beautifully about, he came back to Stanford. A lot of this came out of his work at Stanford. But he read up on the Stoics. And when he was flying over North Vietnam and his plane was shot out from under him, and he was parachuting down into North Vietnam, into Hanoi, he told himself that he was entering the world of the Stoics, that he was going to be in a very strange new world. And he simply, in order to get through it, he had to be stoical. That the torture and the brutality that they faced, and a number of people snapped, as you well know. It was like the same thing was true of people who went through the Holocaust. They had to find, you know, Viktor Frankl, you know, talks and has written wonderfully about that. But what the people who endured were the people who had that sort of inner peace, and they'd come to grips with what they could change and what they couldn't. And many of them survived. Some of them survived.
Yeah. I want to pull another great line in your book, David.
You've read it so well. I'm terribly grateful.
This one's stuck out for me. You note it's an an old African proverb that Patty Stonecipher at the Gates Foundation long ago.
Is
if you want to go, talking about leadership, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together.
Yes.
What is that all about?
Well, it is an old African proverb, and Patty Stonecipher, who was the first CEO of the Gates Foundation, used to use this frequently. But I think it points to a larger reality that for much of history, we thought of leadership as of leaders as sort of a singular individual, the knight on a white horse coming to rescue us. If you think about John Kennedy, one of the pictures that is haunting from his presidency is of Kennedy alone in the Oval Office at dusk, leaning over a table and I think a globe, and you felt he was all alone and in a lonely position, and you felt that, you know, he's got the weight of the world on his shoulders. And we call that the great man theory of leadership, that he was that kind of person. But if you go fast forward now to Barack Obama and think about what the most memorable picture, one of the most memorable pictures in his presidency, it's when he was down in the Situation Room late at night when we were chasing Osama. And Obama's there, but he's surrounded by 8 or 9 of his top people, Secretary of State, Secretary of this, Secretary of that, NSC. And it became very apparent that we had this great man idea versus constructive collaboration as an alternative way of looking at it. And in truth, I think leaders do need to be able to work across boundaries. It's not enough just to get yourself up and strengthen yourself and then just have a small organization of your own. But how do you bring along people who are in a different organization, who are somewhere else? How do you create systems change? It's not enough to go into start up a nonprofit, as so many wonderful people have. And serve 500 people over 10 years' time. It's such a small number that you have to find ways to really change the system itself. And that's me and me more thoughtful about that. And how do you work with others? So this is constructive collaboration as a role model, as a theory of how to get things done, that you work with through a lot of parties, through networks, and through creating a culture. As many reservations as I have about Republicans these days, the truth is, there were a lot of people who have been working on this abortion issue for 20, 30, 50 years. And I disagree with them, but I must say I respect them for working so hard on something they care about, pushing the issue. I think the rest of us ought to engage in the struggle to overcome it. But I think people talking to each other across boundaries and living together and across boundaries is really important. That's what happened when people went to the war to fight, and they fought under the same flag and they became bonded. How do we create bonds today, bonds of trust, empathy, understanding? I think we need more focus from our leaders and less conversation about money and all the other things that don't get very far. I mean, we've done no favors to universities to take presidents of universities out of their role of being moral role models to how much money has that person raised.
Right. You know,
that we're doing them no favors. One university, I remember the president every year in a freshman had a freshman seminar on ethics. And that to me struck me as that's really smart.
Yeah, you bet. We're almost out of time, so I have one more question for you.
Sure.
It's going to involve a little bit of introspection, but before you answer, I want to pull another quote from your book, because this one's really, it's salient here. This is Ronald Reagan's words about you when you were just about to leave the White House under his leadership, and he He wrote in a letter to you, "For 3 years, David has served me with exceptional creativity, loyalty, and dedication." President Ford would have shaken his head yes in agreement, because he would have known from his own days at the White House, Dave is devoted to honest, open, and decent government, and we shall miss him. I thought, boy, those are some really kind words from a great leader. And I'm sure, you know, just words like that have really made your career and your life worthwhile.
Yes, I agree. That kind of commentary, or that kind of feedback or response, of course, is very welcomed. But again, I think whatever I participated in the Reagan administration and in others, but especially the Reagan administration, was because at the end of the day, we did have a team, people who worked together. Reagan brought people together, very different backgrounds. I mean, the fact that he wanted me to work for him, I guess, because, even though I think he knew I was pro-choice and had other issues on which we were somewhat disagreement. I must say that I also find it one of the most gratifying things about teaching is your ability to meet students along the way and then see them change and grow and thrive. And that's been a very sustaining for me to watch. And as I say, and as I wrote in the book, it's, I think it's so important about this that, we shouldn't be discouraged by what we see today, every day. We shouldn't sort of throw it over and say it's not gonna, we can't get any better. We are better than what we're going through. We can make it through this. We've had leaders in the past, and we can have leaders in the future who can bring us together, and you can become one of them. You have a chance when you're in your 20s and 30s to begin a journey that you really can make a difference in this country. And keep that in mind. Have role models. Look for courage. Look for capacity. But look for character too.
Yeah. Well, David, A, thank you for your time. B, thank you for teaching us such a great deal with this wonderful book about leadership. And thank you really honestly, David, for your lifetime of service to this nation. It's really remarkable. And I hope that you're as proud of your accomplishments as the world is.
Oh, you're very kind, and thank you. Good luck.
All the best to you, David.
Okay, John, good.
Signed copies of Hearts Touched by Fire can be purchased through the Reagan Library Museum Store. Every purchase you make from our catalog, website, or museum store is a critical component to our success. In short, your purchase supports our efforts to extend the legacy of President Ronald Reagan. Purchases can be made at reaganlibrary.com/store. To find a listing of all upcoming events, please visit reaganfoundation.org/events. Thank you for listening. For more information on the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute, including information on how to become a member, information on upcoming exhibits at the Reagan Library, and more information on the legacy of President Reagan, please visit reaganfoundation.org. And don't forget to like and follow the Reagan Foundation on all social media platforms.
Until next week, thanks for listening. God bless you.
Don't forget to subscribe to A Reagan Forum podcast in your iTunes or Google Play stores and on other podcast platforms as they become available. New episodes of A Reagan Forum come out every Thursday. Like what you hear? Check out our Words to Live By podcast featuring radio addresses and speeches Ronald Reagan delivered from the 1960s through the 1980s. New episodes drop every Tuesday. And don't forget to follow at Ronald Reagan on Facebook, at Ronald Reagan on Twitter, and Reagan Foundation on YouTube. Also, search for us on SoundCloud and Stitcher.